Once upon a time, there was a king who decided to build a castle that would stand forever. The wind would wear down the mountains, the river would cut scars into the sea. People would be born and they would die. The stars would shift in the sky, but the king's castle would remain. From its window, the king would watch eternity pass by. The king decided that cut into the walls of his castle, from which he would watch the ages, there needed to be written words that would always be true. And so he took the blueprints, and he went to see the wisest people in the land, the scribes, the priests, the elders. And he rolled the plans out on the table before them. And he said, "On the walls of my castle, from which I shall watch the centuries, must be written words of unchanging truth. I command you to find those words for me." And the wise people said, "Yes, so, king." I mean, what choice did they have? They could see from the blueprints that the castle was going to have a substantial dungeon. And so the wise people worked and worked. They prayed and prayed. They thought and thought. Months passed. But eventually they came up with the words that would always be true. They wrote them on a scroll. And they drew lots to see who would take them to the king. The woman who drew the short lot summoned up her courage. She took the scroll. And she began walking towards the king's castle. She walked in its entrance. It was still under construction, and there was scaffolding and drywall dust everywhere. But the king had already moved into his chamber. He couldn't wait to get eternity started. And so the wise woman stood before the king, and she unrolled the scroll with the words that would always be true written on it. There were four of them. The scroll said, "This too shall pass." It has been more than 10 years since someone told me that story, and in the intervening time, like a joke or an urban legend, it has shifted like sand in my mind. I'd be curious to go back and hear the original now. I think of that story every time I hear a reading from the book of Jeremiah. This Sunday and the five Sundays before it, the folks who framed the lectionary have us walking with Jeremiah through the book which bears his name. Jeremiah, who is the most achingly human of all the prophets, who over the course of his career suffers from crushing doubt, from depression, from anger at injustice, from the gnawing sense that God has forgotten about him, and who balances these things with a passion, a wild and sometimes joyous passion for proclaiming God's message that empire is over and that God's kingdom is coming. If what Rabbi Herschel said in the first century is true, that you can sum up all of Scripture with the words, "Love your neighbor as yourself, and the rest is but commentary," well, you can say something similar about Jeremiah. All of Jeremiah can be summed up with the words, "This too shall pass." Jeremiah proclaims his message that permanence is a fantasy in a lot of different ways. He shouts his message at anyone who will listen, eventually wearing out his welcome so badly that he gets thrown into a well. He writes his message down, having his servant Baruch deliver it to the king. The king is so unhappy with the message, he tears it into pieces. And maybe most tantalizingly of all, he puts on performances. He plays his message that this too shall pass. Now, whether or not you receive Jeremiah's proclamation as good news or bad news has a lot to do with whether or not you're standing inside or outside of the king's castle, whether you live in the first world whether you'll have a roof over your head when you go to sleep tonight, whether you have an investment portfolio, whether you're invested in seeing the church remain just as it was in 1965, or whether, to use the example at hand, whether you're a member of the invading army or the defeated people as the army beats on the gate of Jerusalem, about to overrun it. Where do you stand? And does the possibility of change, of the end of permanence, strike you as cause for joy or for fear? I suppose I am most captivated by Jeremiah's performances because prior to coming to Berkeley and to seminary, I worked in the performing arts as a stage manager. And I believe that the arts are prophetic by their very definition. There is something countercultural and wildly joyous about devoting your life to the creation of beauty. It's a divine occupation. The metaphor that we most often use for God, that God is a father, may well be onto something. I'm a father and I connect with that. But I wonder also about that other metaphor, that God is an artist, and that this creation and we are God's work of art. The other thing the arts can do is tell the truth with an immediacy and a power that words alone can rarely match. In the concentration camp Terezin, the prisoners wrote and performed the opera, The Emperor of Atlantis, in which they told the truth, in which they lampooned their captors. They could have never spoken those words to the Nazis, but they were able to sing them. Jeremiah does much the same thing. Imprisoned by King Zedekiah, who can order his execution with a snap of his fingers, faced with the king's question, "Why do you prophesy that Jerusalem is going to fall?" Jeremiah puts on a play. Now, depending on which scholar you ask, Jeremiah puts on three or maybe five plays over the course of his career. Earlier on, God comes to Jeremiah and says, "Go and buy a jug. Take it, gather the leaders of Jerusalem, march them out to the scrap heap, and then smash the jug in the ground before them." Later on, in what might be the oddest thing that God asks anyone to do in all of Scripture, God says to Jeremiah, "Go and buy a set of underpants, a really nice set of underpants. Put them on and walk hundreds of miles. Don't take them off the whole time. And then bury them in the silt by the river." And what do you know? Later on, when God tells Jeremiah to go dig the underpants up, they're wrecked. Nobody wants to wear them. And today, with the sound of the invading army just outside the gates, with the inconceivable about to happen, and God's city about to be overrun, God's people about to be utterly defeated and put into captivity, God tells Jeremiah to go and buy real estate. Go and buy. These are the words which begin all of Jeremiah's performances. Take this symbol of permanence, of power, of empire, and exchange it for a good, and then destroy that good. It is a shocking, appalling act. This is what later theater artists would refer to as theater of cruelty. It is theater designed to shock its audience out of its complacency, to make them realize the reality of decay, of death, of change. The purchase of the field might be the most shocking play that Jeremiah puts on of them all. Here he is, imprisoned by the king, realizing that the city is about to be overrun, realizing that he is about to be taken off into captivity, or possibly death, and he conducts this absurdly specific real estate deal. He lines up the money, he weighs it out, he assembles the witnesses who magically appear for the purpose, And then he writes the deed, signing it in duplicate. Finally, he charges his servant Baruch. Baruch, who is kind of the Sancho Panza to Jeremiah's Don Quixote, to take the deed, to put it into an earthenware jar, so that it may last for a long, long time. Now, to really appreciate the absurdity, the gallows humor of what's taking place here, imagine this scene taking place with a mushroom cloud in the background. Folks, this is not a real estate deal. This is a satire of a real estate deal. It's the end of the world as we know it, but I have got a great deal for you on stocks. This too shall pass. Empire is predicated on the illusion of permanence, on the idea that the rules and the laws and the structures it has created will last forever, that they are unchangeable, eternal, non-negotiable. This is why empire is so invested in the use and the misuse of ritual. Consider the execution of a prisoner. An execution is a perversion of liturgy. It is a perversion of what we do on a Sunday. People wearing uniforms stand up and sit down at precisely prescribed times. They process. They venerate an icon, which is the telephone to the governor. There's even a sermon, last words, before the sacrifice is led to the altar. And this ritual has one purpose and one purpose only. It is to create a sense of inevitability. It is to deny the reality that one group of people are choosing to kill another. Consider, conversely, how upset empire becomes when someone has the indecency to commit violence without putting on a uniform first. That person has stolen empire's ownership of violence. Consider the theme of one national anthem after another. Always, forever, still, yet. The empire, like God, is going to last forever. And then somebody like Jeremiah, or Jonathan Swift, or Stephen Colbert comes along and invites us to laugh. The instability introduced by a satirist is disquieting enough, but the instability introduced when history proves that satirist right is quite another matter. That is terrifying. My German grandfather lived through this not once but twice. After each world war, he watched as the symbol of empire, in his case not the dollar but the Deutschmark, dissolved in his hands. He held it as it turned into paper. That is a terrifying change, but it's also a hopeful one. Because as anyone who's ever spent time in a garden or on a farm knows, decay is the prerequisite for new life. Death is the prerequisite for resurrection. Now, notice that I say hopeful here, not optimistic. This is not about the facile message that everything is going to be okay, that things are going to go back to normal. It's not about the magical evaporation of the subprime mortgage crisis, or the disappearance of the war in Iraq, or the vanishing of the Babylonians at the gate. It's rather about saying that there is new life coming even in the broken stone of what was, like a blade of grass fighting its way up through the asphalt. This is a kind of hope that we are hungry for. I know it's a kind of hope that I'm hungry for. What if the story that we've been told isn't true? What if the stock market going up and down isn't a reliable metric of how well the world is doing? What if the bad news that I keep hearing, that the generation I belong to and that many of you belong to, will be the first in many to be poorer than its parents? What if that's not bad news at all? What if we need to get poorer? What if the bad news that the church lives with that we're running out of people who come on a Sunday out of a sense of duty is just what we've been praying for. Suddenly, you are surrounded by people who are here because they want to be. How exciting is that? What if it's the end of the world as we know it? Is that frightening? It is. Part of me, a big part of me, longs for permanence. It longs for Empire's story to be true. And are we allowed to mourn for what was? Yes. But we're also allowed to celebrate, to hope for what is coming, for the new life that is already growing. Notice in Jeremiah's story, what he is ultimately buying is dirt. Is there a more basic symbol of decay and of new life? Remember, you are dust, and to dust you will return. How does the story of the king and his castle end? In the version that I heard 10 or more years ago, the king reads the words in the scroll and he flies into a rage. Spit comes blasting out of his mouth and the wise woman flees in terror. And maybe that's what happens. Last time I told this story, someone said to me, "I don't think that's what happens at all. I think the king sees the words and he realizes his mistake. He clues into his hubris, he has a moment of clarity, and he orders that the castle be taken apart one brick at a time." And maybe that's what happens too. But here's what I think happens. I think the wise woman looks at the king's eyes, past the shaking hands with which she holds the scroll, and she sees in those eyes not anger, not surprise, but recognition. The king knew what the scroll would say even before the wise woman unrolled it. He knew what it would say even before he commissioned the wise people to begin their work. Yes. And so the king thanks the wise woman and he sends her on his way. And then he calls the stonecutters and directs them to begin the work of cutting the words that will always be true into the wall of the castle. He watches them work, standing in the window of his personal eternity. There is a sad smile on his face. And then one day, months after the construction is done, after all the workers have gone home, the king gets up early, before the sun, before his servants, and he walks out the front gate of the castle, out into the dirt roads of the country. The only other people up this early are farmers, but they don't recognize him. They've never seen him up close before, never seen him anywhere other than the window of his castle. And so he keeps walking until he stops at last in a field. And there, the king reaches down and he scoops up a clod of earth. The king watches as the clay of which he is made runs through his fingers. The sun rises then, and the world is lit up with 1,000 colors. It is a new day, full of new life. It's so beautiful.